This is the Disaster Recovery Hour. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
Hey, good afternoon. That's right. That's Chris Plunkett. I am the host of Disaster Recovery Hour. Every Tuesday, 1 o'clock until about 2. 2 and change sometimes if I run a little long. Again, WVNJ, 1160 AM, The Voice. I just want to say, bring a little update. I was trying to get Brian Loberg, who was from Wanda, we had on last week. He called in from Japan, and he was en route to going up north with supplies. Wanda is a nonprofit organization that helps here in the United States when disasters strike, like Joplin and the floods and things like that. we've had a very good show with Jim Arnett, who is the director of Wanda. Anyway, I had Brian on the line last week trying to give us a little intel on what was happening over there. I mean, you get the regular news. We were trying to get more of, the nonprofit, the man on the boots on the ground, if you will, the intel along those lines. And the difficulties of getting into the hot zone with supplies for obvious reasons. But he just got back, I think it was last night, and he's up in Canada, so he's sleeping. I woke him up last week. I think at 2:30 in the morning to do the show, so it was he was doing the Lord's work for me, helping the show, bring some information to the people. I mean, we have a very large Japanese population here in the Northeast area, the Metro New York City area. A lot of people from the Asian part of the world. So Brian, stay asleep. No need to call in today. I have a guest today, Steve Cremendo. I met Steve at a symposium last three or four weeks ago with ACP Metro. That's the Associated of Contingency Planners, and that was held in New York City. I got a hold of this association through another person who belongs to the Long Island chapter, and the ACP is Association of Contingency Planners, and they're all about keeping businesses in business, doing business, and if there is a disaster, whether it's man-made, whether it's natural, the tools and the tricks and the trades of being in business and relocating and supplies, and it doesn't get enough credit, doesn't have enough ink in my world, how I look at it, because 1 in 4 businesses don't recover from a disaster. It's like 40% in some areas, and in other areas, the urban areas are a little more resilient when it comes to natural disasters, opposed to like the Midwest and the South, where large areas get devastated, like the Mississippi floodings. I mean, you have the residuals from this floodings down the Mississippi. Is a lot of parts of the country are not receiving goods because the Mississippi is a main artery in the United States for moving goods up and down the river. Splits basically the country in half, not literally in half, but you know what I'm saying. So business continuity and keeping people in business. And you know what business does? Businesses pay taxes, so that's very important to the government. It's good for us. We get our we get to have fire departments, whether paid or volunteer, and ambulances and the guys in blue and things like that, and you know, your town guys. So with that, Steve, you're on the line, aren't you?
I am.
How are you?
I am good today. Thanks.
Good. Steve is the director of Extreme Behavioral Risk Management, XBRM. You have a lot of degrees and certifications. Why don't we bring up the listeners? I met Steve at this, like I said, the symposium in New York City, and we talked about. He was talking to us about the behaviorals of disasters, whether it's 9/11, whether it could be Joplin, the Mississippi, even Japan. Steve is in the forefront of educating others and how to deal with the masses, if you will. Is it kind of a synopsis of that, Steve? Is that correct?
Yeah, you're on.
All right. So, Steve, why don't we, with the symposium that I was at with you, which was a great, it felt like it was 3 minutes and it was an hour and change. It just flew. I don't think the human factor. We always look at, especially in my world with the property emergency damage. It's always okay. Can I fix it or can I rehab it? Can bring it back to where people have normal lives? But we have the human asset. We have the mind that is shaken by these disasters. So why don't we roll with let's give a little background from your side and roll from there.
Well, you're right, Chris. I mean, certainly when we look at emergency management and disaster recovery, unfortunately, the people piece of it, really in terms of how people behave and so forth tends to be an afterthought. But when we look at how disasters really unfold, obviously what people are doing before, during, and after make a critical difference in the ultimate outcome of any sort of event, whether it's a large-scale natural disaster, an act of mass violence such as terrorism or a shooting event, disease outbreak, really anything. People are at the heart of that. And, you know, two things I think really that we need to anchor ourselves around is that, you know, when we look at statistics around disasters, the rate of natural disasters alone has quadrupled over the last two decades. We've gone from about 120 natural disasters a year to now more than 500 natural disasters a year. But the multiplier here, our concern, is global population is increasing dramatically at the same time. We're at about 6.8 billion people today on the globe, at about 7 billion by this Halloween, 8 billion by 2015, 9 billion in 2045. That's about a 50% increase in the world population in our lifetime.
More.
When we talk about more disasters, an obvious trend, and more people than we've ever had in recorded history, the importance of getting the people piece of disaster response and recovery right honestly could not be more critical. And it's a very undeveloped aspect of the field. There's a good body, but unfortunately not a big enough body of research yet that tells us how to anticipate people's behaviors and how to factor those into disaster planning. But we're getting there, and as the fields of disaster recovery and business continuity and so forth have matured, they're slowly catching up with the recognition that the people piece can't be an afterthought, that we need to really gain a better understanding of how people behave in different sorts of disasters, because obviously they're going to be part of either the solution or the problem in a real-time event.
So now you served on the faculty at Rutgers Center for Management Development and Fairleigh Dickinson University Graduate Program to Management of Organizational Behavioral. Where is there a disconnect that's happening with that? I mean, do you teach a class, or do you inform business owners or even government? Because I know you're an expert in the traumatic stress and a board certified expert in traumatic stress and level 3 certification with Homeland Security. So you're talking with some top dogs, if you will, and you're trying to break it down for a simpler to get it out to the public. I mean, the public is, you know, again, a large asset that we have, and controlling, but informing, it's a daunting task, no?
It's a big task, but as soon as you start to really have the discussion with people at a leadership level and even people in the community, it becomes very obvious of the importance of how to do this. Disaster management in general and moving people towards preparedness is always a challenge. To have them think about how to really prepare for the people piece of it, something less tangible than, you know, buying boots and suits and all the gear we need, can be difficult for folks to wrap their mind around. But on the other hand, anyone who's been through a disaster or even a fairly realistic exercise or drill starts to understand just what a huge critical link the behavioral piece is. So one thing, I mean, to kind of bring it to the level of leadership, the Department of Homeland Security about 2 years ago now actually stood up a behavioral science human factors division within the Science and Technology Directorate that's dedicated to a number of different human factors issues and disasters in Homeland Security, but one of them is actually community and organizational resilience. We know that in the different standards of various organizations that accredit and regulate, those organizations helping to promote disaster planning, there is increasingly language in those regs about making sure that there are things in place to address the human factors in both planning, response, and recovery. So, as I say, there's a growing maturity in the field of business continuity planning and disaster recovery. There's kind of a growing recognition in the private sector and governments as well. And the other thing, too, I mean, that's really driving this is our threat matrix has really become a lot more sophisticated and complex. Post 9/11, I was taken off my role as a responder at Ground Zero and New Jersey's Family Assistance Center for about 2 weeks and moved down to run psychological operations at our anthrax screening center in Hamilton and Princeton, New Jersey. And obviously, a night and day sort of distinction and difference in how people were behaving and responding to the catastrophic attacks in New York and so forth, as they were to the anthrax exposures. And all the folks, you know, to the majority were, who came through our anthrax screening center, realistically believed that they had been exposed to anthrax in the mail. And in fact, many of them had been. They were there to get their nasal swab, their baggie of Cipro, and so forth. But it started to really raise to the level of leadership an awareness that people do not behave the same way in all different sorts of disaster scenarios, and that the kind of all-size-fits-all or all-hazards model plans that we write sometimes do not sufficiently accommodate human behavior that, as I said, is really at the center of everything we do.
Right. I mean, Japan, number one, supposedly the number one prepared country in the world, was not prepared for that onslaught of damage. And then how do they react from there? So, yeah, I guess it has to be a la carte to a degree, you know.
There's aspects of it that can be standardized that apply across all disaster types when we talk about behavior, and I'll share some of that with you in just a few moments. And there's some things that you're right do have to be very specifically considered for, you know, unique behavior types. And one, for example, back probably about 5 years or more ago, the Department of Homeland Security had invited me to participate in a working group, and it was specifically to talk about the psychological management of RDDs, of dirty bomb scenarios. It's a very, very complex and exotic sort of emergency, and it brings out behaviors that are not anything like that you would see in a natural disaster or many other types of technological disasters. It's very, very specific. And they understood, going into the project, trying to apply models and understandings of how people behave in disasters in general was not going to fit the bill in helping people prepare for, or responders prepare for, what the human reaction would be, the emotional reaction to exposure to radiation. Now, you brought this up in terms of Japan, and obviously a natural disaster that cascaded into a large technological disaster with the nuclear crisis, unfortunately getting, you know, the double whammy, as it were, of both those sorts of disasters, but they both produce radically different behavioral responses that don't lend themselves well to kind of, as I said, a one-size-fits-all approach.
Right. You know, for me, in my world with my emergency services with fires and floods, you know, I'm dealing with one or two people as a homeowner, but then there's times where I get in the city where there's, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 floors, and you see that there's a movement of behavioral that is led by a few. And is that what you encounter when you get to some of these sites? Because, I mean,
there's obviously the potential for that. In fact, this calendar year, 2011, a lot of my professional time has been dedicated to speaking and teaching about the group, crowd, and mob behavior in emergencies and disasters based on what we've seen in North Africa and the Middle East and in this Arab Spring. And again, emergency responders say, well, you know, obviously, could things like that happen here? Not necessarily the political unrest, but group, crowd, and mob behaviors. And yeah, we have seen episodes of that. Well, you know, whether it's the one or two individuals, a small group or crowd of 12 or 15, or literally thousands of people who can form instantly in a flash mob now, given you know, Twitter and our other social networks, it's important that emergency responders and their leaders understand behavior across that whole spectrum, from the individual to the large group, crowd, or mob, because obviously, even when we think about group, crowds, and mobs, we can't have a one-size-fits-all approach. If we underreact, if we overreact, we potentially escalate the situations to very dangerous levels. So, yeah, it's part of our thinking, and certainly what I see in emergencies, but, you know, our experience in dealing with the behavioral piece does range right down to the single individual or family, and then, as I mentioned, up to what we'll call collective behaviors, or really large, large gatherings of people during disasters.
We're going to go to a break, and then, Steve, one of the things you talked about was downtown with the first responders. I know you were at St. Paul and Trinity speaking with guys. Just want to talk about that with that psychological effects on the whole region. Let's go to a break, and we'll be right back with Steve.
Sure.
Thanks.
When
When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need action fast. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration will find the visible and hidden damage caused by a fire or flood. With quick response and correctly applied damage mitigation protocols, CPP can save you valuable time and money and get you back in the game of life. Anytime disaster strikes, quick, focused action is what can save your property. CPP's professional staff is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. To reach CPP Emergency Services and Restoration anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's www.cppems.com, cppems.com. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration, servicing the New York Metro and Tri-State area.
The money is all dried up, and the work is all gone. Don't want to go to the mailbox, don't want to answer the phone. Did I mention my baby left me? Therefore,
attorney Michael Guidro is the cure for your bankruptcy blues. With a bankruptcy success rate of nearly 100%, Michael Guidro is an expert in bankruptcy, credit card settlement, and loan modification. For a consultation, call 201-837-7777. 201-837-7777. Call today and get rid of your bankruptcy blues.
In the early hours after the tsunami, it was ham radio that was on the air, saving lives. When Florida was ripped by hurricanes, the hams were there. In the critical moments after the attack of 9/11, it was the hams who coordinated emergency messages. When disasters strike, the hams are ready. Ham radio works when other communications don't. To learn how you can become a ham radio operator, call the ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, at 1-800-326-3942.
Welcome back. Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett, every Tuesday between 1 and 2. My guest today on the phone, calling in from the city, New York City that is Steve Gremendo. Steve is the Director of Extreme Behavioral Risk Management. Steve, before we went to the break, we give you a little heads up. You talked about working with the first responders downtown, and we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary. And I know you have some new information out there. You want to talk about that experience and the new information that you just produced?
Yeah, Chris, actually, you know, coming up on this 10th anniversary in the next couple months of 9/11, the anniversary obviously will receive much more attention than the previous anniversaries, I would imagine, other than the very first anniversary. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, especially people who are directly affected, the folks on the response, recovery and rescue teams there, anniversaries in general tend to stir a lot up, and this anniversary we think is in particular going to really stir up a lot for folks. I published actually today on our website, which is www.xbrm.com, a new white paper that's specifically about anticipating the emotional and behavioral challenges of the 9/11 emergency, or 9/11 anniversary rather, for first responders, for law enforcement and security personnel, and so forth. So for people interested in that, certainly I'd direct them there and take a mm-hmm. look at the paper. But, first responders and everyone in that environment, part of what's so different is the degree of exposure and the intensity of what they're up against compared to, the general population. We know that the effects of that can range from just be temporarily disorienting and shocking up to potentially individuals with diagnosable PTSD that can be a lifetime sort of condition. Mm. So I think one of the important things that I like to share, Chris, is we really look at the behavioral aspects of disasters through this lens we sometimes refer to as tactical psychology, which means the use of clinical information for its tactical or operational value, not just the clinical. So there's a significant part of the discussion that is about the mental health impact of a disaster, of people who will go on to have sometimes lasting problems. But one thing that's important for your audience to know is, of course, I'm sure most are aware, the most common sort of disaster is a natural disaster. And even in natural disasters, only about 11 to 15% of the population exposed goes on to develop lasting mental health problems. And what we should take away from that is 85% or more don't. The vast majority of people do rebound in their own times, on their own terms, using their own support systems, and not necessarily needing, you know, mental health intervention, treatment, medications, anything like that. Most people bounce back, and in fact, they're not psychologically damaged goods. But on the tactical aspect of this, we take that same information about human behavior, not for its mental health value now, but for its operational value. What should police, fire, rescue personnel, what should Office of Emergency Management people up to the level of FEMA and Homeland Security, what should folks know about how people are most likely to behave in different disaster scenarios that can help them structure the most effective response to the situation, minimizing both the traumatic impact on the responders as well as the population that they're you know, assisting during a disaster. So there's really kind of two edges to the swords of the behavioral discussion. On one side is the clinical for its mental health value, and the other side is the tactical, and how do we understand the human behavior for its really, you know, boots on the ground application.
It's the natural disaster, the terroristic, the terror disasters, people healing on their own, or I'm not saying self, you know, self-evaluating themselves, but seeking help. So the 15% and 80% on the natural disaster side. Now, being downtown, you had your first responders, thousands of first responders. Did you see more of the first responders, or did you see more of the people who, like, say, in Battery Park City, where I worked when they went down, trying to get their lives back to normal? Did you see more on percentage-wise on the civilians or on the first responders on seeking those types
in terms of seeking
help?
Assistance? Well, yeah. A couple things. First of all, again, in disasters in general, including the 9/11 event, there's tends to be a delayed help-seeking response in the public, and especially in responders. Responders, because they get very very committed to the task, usually don't want to poke their heads up and come out and ask for or receive any sort of mental health assistance when they're, you know, so busy doing their work. It tends not to be until really the situation is broken down and demobilizes that either, you know, most responders either seek help or that our systems tend to really promote and reach out and offer that help. What we've learned historically is most responder and responder agencies are not as willing to use that during the actual, you know, rescue or recovery phase. Now, that same dynamic works to a degree on the public side in the community of that delayed help seeking. Most people have a whole list of other kind of things they need to tend to in the wake of a disaster, and that kind of mental health support for most people is low on the list. There's also the stigma against using mental health services.
Right.
That's not for me. I'm not crazy. I don't have that sort of problem. And people tend not to go look for that. But what we see when we know nationally is in the wake of disasters, we do slowly see about a 20% increase in new mental health, kind of cases, people seeking assistance at the community level over the next 3 years post-event. So there's this very slow kind of tendency of people to come around and look for that support, but not in the immediate wake. Today we have a model nationally. It's endorsed by the National Academy of Science, the Institute of Medicine. It's referred to as psychological first aid,
which is
the kind of mental health support that we deliver in the 0 to 48 hours of the event. That's preferable. There's a whole lot of good science behind why that's important to do, but there's also many disaster types in which we're not able to provide that in the 0 to 48, or a lot of people are just not willing to connect and utilize that sort of mental health support because they're just tied up with, you know, myriad other kinds of critical survival tasks in those first days.
Daily life deflections.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you just join us at WVNJ 1160, this is a Disaster Recovery Hour. Chris Plunkett, your host, on the phone with me, calling from the city, is Steve Grimendo. Steve, regarding, it is people have these traumatic events on a large scale. They do. They want to rebuild something. So it takes away from, the worst neighborhood you can go to is in between your ears, I believe. And that's what most people say. So with that said, getting the locals, local communities, and you would go from municipalities and such, getting that word out. There is a formula per se that you could hand over and say this is the ABCs.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, at the most basic level, going back to your statement about how people get stuck in their own heads with the stress and the misery of a disaster, is an expression we use, which is action binds anxiety. And giving people things to do, tangible ways to recover, both physically and psychologically, tends to really anchor them and ground them. And I wouldn't necessarily say distract, but refocus a lot of the energy that might be turned inward on, ruminating about their problems and their struggles now, to something purposeful. Even at the federal level, Chris, I think you're probably in your audience, many would be familiar with the Stafford Act. And, in federal legislation, the Stafford Act kind of requires, in part, parts of their mandate, that all states have a state disaster mental health plan, and all states have the capacity to deliver disaster mental health services. Well, certainly for your listenership here in the New York metro area, both New York State, New Jersey, New York City have very robust disaster mental health response capabilities. New Jersey Exceptional has the only certification for mental health professionals called the DRCC, or Disaster Response Crisis Counselor certification. So the mental health responders in that state go through a really robust training, background checks, everything to put them on the front line of a disaster as part of the first response.
Mm-hmm.
That's true in most states. Right now there's a coalition or consortium of 37 states in the U.S. that participate as a disaster behavioral health consortium and work together to deliver those sort of services. So there is, for the lack of a better term, if not a formula, models and systems of how and what sort of mental health services get delivered to a community in the wake of a disaster that make a difference in getting people back. And I guess, if I could just breathe one more kind of word about this, it's important for people to understand the purpose of those kind of mental health interventions in the wake of a disaster. And it's summarized very well by this statement. The purpose of psychotherapy is to create change. People go to the therapist because they want to change something in their relationships, the way they think, they work, they feel. The purpose of disaster mental health intervention is to prevent change and get people back to their baseline levels of functioning as quickly as possible. So for lots of people who might say in the wake of a disaster, I don't want to use that mental health stuff, I'm not that kind of person, I don't want to be talking to the therapist about my mom, my dad, my relationships, my childhood. First of all, they're not probably talking to a therapist. There's lots of other mental health workers who are out on the front line of disasters who are not people who, have you on the couch in therapy. And the whole model is, in fact, very radically different than a psychotherapy model. It's designed, instead of producing change, as I said, to prevent change, because the research here suggests that people who get back to baseline the fastest do the best in long-term recovery. Mm.
We're going to go to a break. I got a couple of questions from the web. So let's pay a couple of bills and be back with Steve in a few minutes.
When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need answers. CPP is the answer. CPP is a full-service emergency services and restoration company. With 25 years of experience in emergency management and restoration, their seasoned team of skilled professionals is ready to assess damages and restore your property to its pre-loss condition.
Who do I call first? What about insurance? Is it safe to stay here? What do I do next?
Fire, smoke, water, or mold, CPP restores your property and your peace of mind. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration, they've got answers. To reach CPP Emergency Services and Restoration anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's cppems.com, cppems.com. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration, servicing the New York Metro and Tri-State area.
I know it's tough to hear me with this firefighter's air pack on, but it's the only way I can be in this smoldering pile of ashes that was my office. And I could get in trouble, but I hope you won't make the same mistake I did, since at least one in four businesses that suffer this type of loss never reopen. So here goes. Just 3 days ago, we sat in this melted wreck of what used to be a conference room talking about how good things were. Over there was the tech room. The fire's bad enough, but the water damage really gets me. Look, here's an article describing us as visionaries. I should have done our disaster plan, but with everything else, I just didn't see this coming. Visionaries, huh? Well, the good news is, at least the ashes can't burn down.
There'll always be a few fires to put out around the office, unless it's not around anymore. But when you have a disaster plan, you can adapt, recover, and stay in control. Go to Ready.gov and make your company's plan. Ready.gov. It's never too late to protect your business until it is. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Do you know that there are some emergency shelters that have no emergency backup generators? You can be prepared and have your own emergency generator for your home and business. Hi, I'm Dan O'Brien from Academy Electrical Contractors Incorporated, a full-service electrical contractor servicing the tri-state area since 1981. Our specialty is generators. We give you a complete turnkey installation, service your existing generator, rent you the temporary machine for that planned shutdown or that unexpected power failure. Academy Electrical Contractors can install a generator to protect your family and business from a power grid failure. Power your heating and air conditioning system, keep your refrigerator and freezer running, power your well pump, or power your sump pump. Visit us on the web at academyelectrical.com. That's academyelectrical.com. Or give me a call at 877-SPARKIES. That's 877-772-7597. Academy Electrical Contractors, generating satisfaction 24/7 since 1981.
Welcome back. Chris Plunkett, Disaster Recovery Hour. Steve, I got a couple of questions, but before we let me not forget to bet that story from South America that you told at the conference. That was very interesting. I wrote it down so this way I wouldn't forget.
Mm-hmm.
The web question is: what does Steve see as the most critical behavioral preparedness issue we face here in New York City?
Well, it's a mix of two things. One is kind of denial, and two is complacency. I mean, the very very good news is that we have not had another substantial terrorist attack. A couple close calls, but in the absence of real events, people do tend to have this sense that the risk is diminished, and we can drop our guard somewhat. Having people take preparedness seriously is difficult everywhere across our country. Denial that things are going to happen, they'll happen here, they'll be as big and bad as they say, tend to suppress people's, ability to prepare. As I said, the other thing we talk about is recency, and if there hasn't been an event recently, it leads people to the perception that nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, in this way, we're kind of our worst enemy. There's lots of good resources your audience is probably keenly familiar with. It's at the national level, the ready.gov sort of websites,
mm-hmm. Right.
In the states, the preparedness sites, lots of organizations that promote preparedness. But actually getting people to commit the time, the little bit of money that's involved, and the space to store supplies, from a behavioral standpoint, getting people, to take that seriously is always the greatest challenge.
Yeah, it's because the citizens who are prepared, and say they have a house fire or a flood, first responders or even downtown terrorist incidents, people that are prepared, because the first responders are not going to be there in 30 seconds. They're going to be there in X amount of hours, depending on the severity of the whole situation. Let's take Katrina, for example, because I know you went down there. It was just so overwhelming that first responders could not get to areas. So being underprepared and drilling that home, the complacency of, nothing's happened lately. And that's, that's a driving force behind the show. Disaster recovery is really disaster recovery and preparedness and getting that word out. And that's why I really liked about the ACP of Metro and Long Island, the contingency plans. I mean, it's, having that backup or having a trump card, if you will, like, boom, here I am prepared. Now, when you went down to Katrina, now that's a different type of disaster. Then you had civil unrest. Then you had finger pointing. How did that? What kind of tools did you apply down there, opposed to say downtown?
Well, in the very early phase, the tools that the approach to counseling and dealing with behavior is fairly similar. It's really kind of helping manage the initial traumatic impact of the event. But I tell you, when we talk instantly about comparing it to downtown, one of the first things you have to hold on to is there is a very significant behavioral difference between acts of terrorism and natural disasters.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When we talk about terrorism, it's a disaster by design. The bad guys have thought and engineered, how do we make this as bad as possible in terms of psychological, social, economic consequences? And when we see terrorism, we actually get much, much higher rates of PTSD and other mental health problems. After Oklahoma City, we're looking at about 41% of the affected population having discernible traumatic stress sorts of symptoms. And I use Oklahoma City as a great benchmark because it was so, so cut and dry in many ways. In this instance, the bomber, Timothy McVeigh, he parks his Ryder rental truck full of explosives, full of ammonium nitrate this day, in front of the child care center at the Murrah Federal
mm-hmm.
Building.
Right.
He didn't have a way to test that device and fully know how powerful it would be, but he knew one thing for sure, which is if anyone's going to get hurt and killed, it's going to be the kids in that daycare center because it has the maximum psychological consequence. So when you see natural disasters and you see acts of terrorism, you do get a very, very different sort of behavioral result. And there, as you move out from the initial impact, it really starts to kind of become more defined how radically different that is. And that's at the place where you start applying different models of maybe psychological support and so forth. So, Chris, one of the things, you may have heard me say and people often hear me say when I speak is there's three key points to understanding the behavioral aspects. And the first is that the human behavior we see in disasters is phase-specific. It's very specific to a timeline. Obviously, the way we react in day one is different than, week one, month one, year one, and so forth. It all changes over that timeline. And the sort of behavior we see and how we assist people also needs to be adjusted at the timeline. The second key point, something you brought up before break, was talking about that situation in South America years ago, is the human response to disaster is hazard-specific. And we brought this up earlier, that people don't react the same way to fire, flood, and earthquake, as a shooting event, as a disease outbreak, as a radiological emergency. And the third point that really brings us to that Latin American case is that there are some emergency types in which the behavioral footprint will completely outsize the physical or medical implications of the event. And the case here, the case in point, at a low level, might be the sarin nerve gas attack in the Tokyo subway in March of 95. The ratio of psychological casualties to medical casualties in that event was 4-1. But the event in September of 87 in Goiânia, Brazil, which was an accidental release of cesium-137, when a couple guys broke into an abandoned medical clinic and stole an orphaned radiation treatment machine, broke it open for scrap metal and exposed themselves and their neighbors to cesium. When word got out in the community about this, the Brazilian government ended up opening the Olympic soccer stadium as a radiation screening site. In the next week and a half, they had 112,000 people show up who truly believed they'd been exposed to the radiation. And of the first 60,000, 5,000 were positive for the signs and symptoms of radiation exposure, although not a single one of them had been exposed. So we have this tremendous kind of psychosomatic or psychogenic response in which people, truly believe and actually manufacture. They're not faking it. You can actually see the symptoms. You can see the rash. You can, hear the cough. But it's based just on their belief they've been exposed. So when we have these events that kind of lack clarity, they lack the bookends, you know, natural disaster, very often you're totally clear. When does it start? When does it stop? And if I'm in or out. But in a disease outbreak or a bioterrorism event or an RDD, dirty bomb sort of scenario, you're talking about hazards that you can't see, smell, hear, or taste, and it produces a radically different behavioral response. Well, right off the bat, a company should understand that. Our first responder organization should understand that. Because, again, if we're applying a one-size-fits-all model, we'll deal with the people this way during a disaster. Mm-hmm. The way people behave in varying disasters is, you know, is so different that you can't apply, you know, that one size. And it's also, as I said, not necessary to have a million different plans, but one base plan that has the flexibility and is based in reality of how people will really behave.
Mm. The Disaster Recovery Hour, if you just joined us. I'm on the phone with Steve Grimendo. He is my guest today. And if anybody, DRH Radio, any questions, any web questions, go to the comments page on drhradio.net. That is drhradio.net. Punch in a question for Steve or myself. You know, Steve, I try to, ever since I've gotten involved with the ACP, when I had some other guys regarding nonprofits, I had no idea how involved that is with Wanda and the guys, and I met in Haiti. Now with the ACP, now you're part of the contingency planning, because this is, it's also very applicable to shooter incidents at factories or post offices or things like that. I mean, they need to have a plan in effect. For assisting with their human toll psychologically.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a business continuity aspect to it. If people are unable or unwilling to come back into work or stay focused on their, you know, their tasks during times of disaster, you know, the organization is going to be in crisis as well. You know, just because the disaster plan that the organization or company says, you know, we're all going to do this, does not necessarily mean people, employees, or even leaders are going to be able to or be willing to do those things. So, you know, one of our challenges always is this idea of behaviorally informed business continuity. Are you making the right assumptions about what people will really do in support of your business plan? And one of the biggest challenges, I mean, we saw this, as you brought up earlier with Katrina, was what we refer to psychologically as person-role conflict. Person-role conflict in Katrina was probably most evident in those rare stories you hear of a police officer or emergency services person who hangs it up, who just, you know, says, I've done all I can do, and it's time for me to go home and check on my home and my family, mm-hmm. and leaves their post. You know, post-abandonment, it can and does happen. It's very rare in emergencies, especially here in the U.S. But that same challenge works in the private sector. If we have individuals who are tasked to be on our company crisis team and part of our disaster recovery process, and they're struggling with those same challenges of, oh my gosh, who do I respond to? My family at home is in dire straits, and they're saying, where are you, and when are you going to come home, and why aren't you here from us? And the company is saying, we need you here. It becomes a very difficult internal kind of, you know, tug of war for any individual. So there's a lot. I mean, that person-role conflict is one of the challenges. There's a lot that leaders need to think about in the business world about, you know, how do we get employees not only to prepare but actually to respond and stay on task during an actual disaster response or recovery operation.
We forget about businesses. You know, sometimes, you know, whole areas, towns get flooded out. Out here in Bergen County, Passaic County, you know, whole areas got flooded out. Forget about the homes, just the businesses. And, you know, that's a driving force of people going back to that sense of normalcy. If you just joined us, it's the Disaster Recovery Hour, WVNJ, 1160 AM, The Voice. Steve, is there a difference from working in the city areas of when a disaster hits, opposed to you know, the rural areas, say Mississippi? It's spread out, you know, the you know.
Well, yeah, there are, and there's not one that's better or worse. I think we tend to always look on the grass is greener sort of things. We've had disasters in the city, and people look and say, well, out in the country, people are more neighborly in different ways, and so forth. And the cities, they look and say, wow, you know, or in the country, rather, I'm 10 miles from my nearest neighbor. At least in the city, you got people all around to help you.
Right.
The thing we see most often in disasters, and it's not like they show it in the movies or in, you know, in the news sometimes even, you do not necessarily get panic. Panic is rare in most disasters. We know exactly what creates panic, and we know how to manage that to a degree. The thing you get most often in the immediate wake of a disaster, I refer to as a type 1 behavioral response. It's neighbor helps neighbor. Type 2, a little different. Neighbor fears neighbor. So if you think about something like a disease outbreak, mm-hmm. you might want to help out and go assist your neighbor, but you have a legitimate fear now of getting sick, so maybe that starts to, you know, make you think twice. Well, that starts to erode the community cohesion that we count on so much in a disaster recovery, the community pulling together. And in the worst-case situation, a type 3 behavioral response, which is neighbor competes with neighbor, and that is when we do, in fact, get panicked. That's kind of based in people's perception that either there's a limited opportunity for escape or there's limited availability of critical supplies, and therefore they actually have to compete with each other based on their idea that they need to be first or they're going to perish.
We're going to go to a commercial break, and because I want to, when you talked about that at the conference, it really applies a lot to how I deal with my situations on a daily basis. But let's go to a commercial break and be back with Steve in a second.
When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need action fast. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration will find the visible and hidden damage caused by a fire or flood. With quick response and correctly applied damage mitigation protocols, CPP can save you valuable time and money and get you back in the game of life. Anytime disaster strikes, quick, focused action is what can save your property. CPP's professional staff is on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. To reach CPP Emergency Services and Restoration anytime, visit them on the web at www.cppems.com. That's www.cppems.com, cppems.com. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration, servicing the New York Metro and Tri-State area.
Do you know that there are some emergency shelters that have no emergency backup generators? You can be prepared and have your own emergency generator for your home and business. Hi, I'm Dan O'Brien from Academy Electrical Contractors Incorporated, a full-service electrical contractor servicing the tri-state area since 1981. Our specialty is generators. We give you a complete turnkey installation, service your existing generator, rent you the temporary machine for that planned shutdown or that unexpected power failure. Academy Electrical Contractors can install a generator to protect your family and business from a power grid failure. Power your heating and air conditioning system, keep your refrigerator and freezer running, power your well pump, or power your sump pump. Visit us on the web at academyelectrical.com. That's academyelectrical.com. Or give me a call at 877-SPARKIES. That's 877-772-7597. Academy Electrical Contractors, generating satisfaction 24/7 since 1981.
At least one in four businesses affected by a disaster never reopen. Let me repeat. At least one in four businesses affected by a disaster, whether it's man-made or natural, never reopen. Yet far too many business owners put off their company's disaster.
You have 5 new messages.
Can you sign it for me, please?
Don't forget those copies for the presentation.
Disaster plan because they let too many day-to-day things get in the way.
Is that 3 p.m. going to be all right with your schedule?
Hey, don't forget that Stan proposes due.
Be in the conference room in 5 minutes, please.
To save your messages, press 1.
Received dispatch, truck 47 en route to 614 North Front Street.
Received. Be advised, truck 47, heavy fire showing from the 9th floor. Second alarm being dispatched at this time.
Disasters are unpredictable, but when you have a plan in place, you can better adapt, recover, and stay in control. So don't wait. Visit ready.gov to make your company's disaster plan. Ready.gov. It's never too late to protect your business until it is. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back, Disaster Recovery Hour. Your host, Chris Plunkett. Guest today is Steve Cremendo. Go to my website. That's drhradio.net. Steve's got his bios on there. Click on his name. Brings you right to his the business he is a director of. Gives you a lot of good insight onto what Steve's driving force is about. Really helping fellow citizens or American citizens. You know, Steve is a member of the FBI's InfraGuard program and serves as a consultant and trainer for the U.S. Department of Justice, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and also United Nations. Now, Steve, I there was a couple of people from the UN at that Metro ACP meeting. Internationally, I mean, we have so many things that are happening in this country, but, you know, the world is flat. Communication is instant. Getting places is quicker than it's ever been. So it's really not, it's become an international type of business, if you will. It's not a business, but, you know, I'll classify it as that.
Oh, it's an international priority.
Priority, correct.
You know, certainly a lot of the attention that's given to disaster response and recovery is on the public sector side and different sorts of governmental and non-governmental organizations like the UN. But then, you know, there is a whole disaster recovery industry, of course, that operates as a business model. And both kind of need to work hand-in-hand, and they do pretty well here in the States and in most of the industrialized countries. In the developing countries, of course, you don't see that kind of privatized organizations interested in disasters much, and really they can be overwhelming. The need they have for the, you know, public sector, non-governmental charity and other relief agencies. So, yeah, they need to work arm in arm, and they most often do.
Before we went to the break, we talked about the three scenarios of neighbor helping neighbor, mm-hmm. neighbor competing with neighbor, and also neighbor. That really breaks it down to neighborhood things like such as myself that I deal with on a daily basis. You know, I don't think, you know, there's not enough ink out there about the neighbor helping the other neighbor. It's always about the adverse, you know, the guy, you know, they have suspicions.
Yeah, that's unfortunate portrayal. It's not accurate. You know, when we look, there's been actually good research done on where even emergency managers get their information about how people behave in disasters. And the two most significant sources are the news media and movies. Well, movies are obviously, they're going to dramatize. They're going to try to make it interesting and emotional and so forth. And not always reflective of what people will really do in disasters. And I'll tell you the truth, even the news media, and not as a criticism, but if there's a large-scale disaster and there's 1,000 people waiting peacefully at a nearby shelter for bottles of water or supplies, and there's 4 knuckleheads up the block who are looting, where do you think the news cameras are going
right.
to?
Yeah.
You know, they're going to the thing that's newsworthy and sensational and dramatic. So the public, as well as, unfortunately, even emergency management officials, very often come away with a very skewed sense of negativity, that people are going to respond poorly. They're going to loot. They're going to scam each other. They're going to, you know, they're going to be hostile and difficult. And as I said, what we typically see is an altruistic neighbor helps neighbor approach, the type one response I mentioned, and of community cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
There are exceptions, of course, you know, no shortage of those. But that doesn't get the press, and we end up with a very skewed sense of what people's behavior is like in disasters.
That's why I watch the PBS NewsHour.
Mm-hmm.
I get the news. I don't get the sensational stuff. It actually happened to me downtown. I was in one of the buildings, and I was splitting with another project manager. And helping this guy out, he was a journalist, and I said, "Listen, you're in a bad situation because, unfortunately, I'm working for a company. Yes, their money is being generated, but for me, I thought I was here. You know, I was looking at it as helping my fellow citizen get back to normal. I know there was money has to be exchanged. I know insurance money or FEMA was giving out money and so on and so forth. But he had written an article about his experience. And one of the things that he just didn't have coverage, the building was fighting with him on certain things because it was an asbestos related. And, you know, we had all those toxins in the air and so on and so forth. At the end of the article, it just says, well, that's how it is. I guess it's all just a business. And I was like, wow, you know, it really wasn't about that. But it spun it into, like, you know, make it a little more of a negative side, so it's going to get better press. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's sad, but that does tend to be the tendency, and it is actually, if you look around the world, it tends to be that way in the media in most countries.
Yeah. So, Steve, a couple minutes to go in the show. What's up next? Any new projects? Are you doing some? You did say that you do a lot of traveling, but your home base is here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And what is anything? ACP affiliated, or I consider my show almost a PSA, you know, a public service announcement. Grant you, I have a job, a day job, and I do emergency services on properties and things like that. But if I could give the intel to somebody, you know, for today is the most important psychologically, because you can replace things, you can't replace human beings and feelings and emotions. Those are critical for normalcy. So what is some of the things in the future that I'd like to have come back on, but what are the things that you're working on presently?
Well, you know, there's a mix of things, both in the public and private sector. In the public side, in organizations, we're doing an awful lot of work with organizations around trying to teach leadership, you know, how to make the right behavioral assumptions. And one of the things is the idea we touched base on before about psychological first aid, which is, you know, the belief from the federal side of the discussion that there should be as many people in our organizations trained in psychological first aid as are trained in CPR.
Right.
Really, in every person's skill set, it's not reserved for the mental health professional. And we see some of the more progressive businesses in the city and around the New York metro area starting to really introduce psychological first aid into their workplace, building that capacity to take care of themselves. You knew you brought it up earlier. There's many emergency types in which other emergency responders might not be able to get to us very quickly, or they're overwhelmed themselves, or there's other priorities. We understand that in terms of physical preparedness, but in terms of psychological preparedness, to know that there's people in our organizations we can turn to for support who have been trained in how to assist with the emotional impact of a disaster is something that is just taking hold in the private sector. So one of our priorities right now in the public or the private side, rather, both in my firm and in our industry, is really trying to spread the word and get out there and produce more psychological first aid responders in the private sector. On the public sector side, something interesting, New Jersey on June 22nd and 23rd will be hosting a two-day conference. It's kind of reserved for folks who are trained disaster mental health responders, but it's a new model approved by the federal government for disaster mental health support called SPR, or Skills for Psychological Recovery. And what that is, Chris, it's a modification of the core ideas of psychological first aid for long-term recovery, the kind that we would do in a Katrina-type situation in which people may need ongoing kind of mental health support for potentially years after the event. So there's a lot that's changing. The good news is we're at a place of maturity in our discipline where it's all kind of very much backed up by good scientific evidence that the models that we're using are safe, they're effective, they do what they ought to do, and they do it across different ages and cultures and all different types of settings. So we're in a very good, positive place right now.
Yes. Steve, it was a pleasure. You know, one quick thing just came to mind, because towards the end, at the end of the show, I always like to say something about the war. Are you involved in anything with the guys getting rotated coming back, or does the government handle that, or the government's bringing you? Because I mean, you're affiliated with many government agencies. Just before we show,
it's both the National Seat of Excellence. And this is probably a good web link for your audience. The National Seat of Excellence for this, really, all that we've discussed here today, Chris, is the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and that's at ncptsd.va.gov. They're part of the VA, obviously, you can see by the address there, but they're kind of the driving force in military stress, military traumatic stress. Obviously, we have so many returning service members that the situation and the kind of mental health needs that they may have integrating back into the community are larger than the VA does itself.
Mm.
So a lot of folks chip in. I'm one of them, but it's a big issue, and we certainly want to provide for those people who have done such a good job taking care of us.
Without a doubt. Steve, it was great. Thanks. I appreciate the coming on. I hope to see you at some ACP meetings. And also, what did you say, June 21 and June 22? Is the
22 and 23, people who would be interested and qualified to attend to those can go to njdrcc.org and see the registration information.
Okay, great. Steve, I appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your day. It is a nice Tuesday. A little warm out there, though. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon. You've been listening to Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host every week, Chris Plunkett. DRHradio.net. Any comments, throw something out there for us. Steve can answer it in the future. And take care, and let's end the war. Bring home our